The Mark Stein Club presents Tales for Our Time.
Welcome along to a first birthday celebration of Tales for Our Time. 1 year ago, May 2017, the strains of Sir Edward Elgar's Imperial March were heard here for the first time to introduce my new series of audio adventures. That Elgar March was written for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897, and I chose it as our theme music not because I'm a 19th century imperialist 100 years past my sell-by date, although I am, but because it has the confidence of the world in which it was written. The tales I've chosen this last year are from long ago, the most recent dates from 1932, but they speak to our time. They are, as they say, relevant, more relevant indeed than, say, a story about a Muslim revert going into the high school transgender bathroom and finding a meth head slumped in the stall. That's mere surface modishness. Our tales, often written as ripping yarns and potboilers to divert a mass audience, nevertheless ripple down through the generations. So herewith, a few highlights from some of our nightly radio serials these past 12 months. If you like them, you can hear them in full, and you can hear more by joining the Mark Stein Club. I love stories on the radio, and have done ever since the BBC's long-gone Listen with Mother, and its famous catchphrase, ad-libbed one January lunchtime in 1950 by the wonderful Julia Lang, about whom I've received a couple of heartening letters this past year from Mark Stein Club members. But as Miss Lang and all her successors across the decades used to say, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin." Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, had a sick wife, and in 1895 they went to Egypt, hoping the climate would alleviate her tuberculosis. No writer likes to waste local colour. So in 1898, Conan Doyle published The Tragedy of the Korosko, the story of a party of Anglo-American French tourists on a trip up the Nile, who wind up getting kidnapped by the ISIS or Al-Qaeda of the day, the followers of the Mahdi. What's striking is how familiar it all is. The sudden intrusion of an unbending savagery upon modern man. Even the techniques are much the same. Then, as now, the jihadists believe the infidels are looking at things back to front, that the advanced scientific mind is, in fact, an effete, arrogant weakness in the face of unquestioning faith. Yet in the end, the English, Irish, and Americans among the party have an instinctive civilizational confidence. They respect their foe in part because they understand that's what he is. It was an odd sensation rereading The Tragedy of the Korosko after 9/11, as innumerable Western academics lined up across the TV studios and public prints to insist that, quote, "poverty breeds desperation," I came across this passage. "It isn't safe to reckon upon a dervish's fears," remarked Brown. "We must always bear in mind that they are not amenable to the same motives as other people. Many of them are anxious to meet death, and all of them are absolute uncompromising believers in destiny. They exist as a reductio ad absurdum of all bigotry, a proof of how surely it leads towards blank barbarism." From Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, The Tragedy of the Korosko.
Mm-hmm. "You do no good by exposing yourself," said Belmont, drawing Colonel Cochrane behind a large, jagged boulder, which already furnished a shelter for three of the Sudanese.
"A bullet is the best we have to hope for," said Cochrane grimly. "What an infernal fool I've been, Belmont, not to protest more energetically against this ridiculous expedition."
"My poor Nora! My poor little Nora!" muttered Belmont in the depths of his grizzled moustache. "What do you suppose they'll do with us, Cochrane?" he asked, after a pause.
"They may cut our throats, or they may take us as slaves to Khartoum. I don't know that there is much to choose. There's one of us out of his troubles, anyhow." The soldier next to them had sat down abruptly and leaned forward over his knees. His movement and attitude were so natural that it was hard to realize that he had been shot through the head. He neither stirred nor groaned. His comrades bent over him for a moment, and then, shrugging their shoulders, they turned their dark faces to the Arabs once more. Belmont picked up the dead man's martini in his ammunition pouch.
"Only three more rounds, Cochrane," said he, with the little brass cylinders upon the palm of his hand. "We've let them shoot too soon and too often. We should have waited for the rush."
"What's the matter with the Frenchman?" Monsieur Faraday was stamping about the plateau with the gestures of a man who has been stung by a wasp. "Sacronon! Sacronon!" he shouted, showing his strong white teeth under his black waxed moustache. He wrung his right hand violently, and as he did so he sent a little spray of blood from his fingertips. A bullet had chipped his wrist. Headingley ran out from the cover where he had been crouching, with the intention of dragging the demented Frenchman into a place of safety. But he had not taken three paces before he was himself hit in the loins, and fell with a dreadful crash among the stones.
He staggered to his feet, and then fell again in the same place, floundering up and down like a horse which has broken its back.
"I'm done," he whispered as the colonel ran to his aid.
And then he lay still with his china-white cheek against the black stones. When, but a year before, he'd wandered under the elms of Cambridge, surely the last fate upon this earth which he could have predicted for himself would be that he would be slain by the bullet of a fanatical Mohammedan in the wilds of the Libyan desert. And now they were herded in at the base of the Abusir Rock. This little group of modern types who had fallen into the rough clutch of the 7th century. For in all save the rifles in their hands, there was nothing to distinguish these men from the desert warriors who first carried the crescent flag out of Arabia. The East does not change, and the Dervish raiders were not less brave, less cruel, or less fanatical than their forebears.
"But this is absurd!" cried the Frenchman excitedly. "Tell him that I'm a Frenchman, dragoman. Tell him that I'm a friend of the Caliphat. Tell him that my countrymen have never had any quarrel with him, but that his enemies are also ours."
"The chief asks what religion you call your own," said Mansour. "The Caliphat, he says, has no necessity for any friendship from those who are infidels and unbelievers."
"Tell him that in France we look upon all religions as good."
"The chief says that none but a blaspheming dog and the son of a dog would say that all religions are one as good as the other.
He says that if you are indeed the friend of the Caliphat, you will accept the Quran and become a true believer upon the spot. If you will do so, he will promise on his side to send you alive to Khartoum.
And if not,
you will fare in the same way as the others."
Thank you.
In Conan Doyle's tale, the jihadists are out on the fringes of the map, on the dusty frontiers of empire, where the Queen Empress's writ runs but fitfully. What happens when the fringe moves to the metropolis, when the Mahdist fanatics walk among us in every Western city? Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, is set in 1886 and was published early in the 20th century, 1907, but nevertheless became one of the most famous books of the early 21st century in the wake of September 11th and the events that followed in Madrid, Bali, Beslan, the London Tube, on and on and on. The Secret Agent is the earliest example of a story that attempts to get into the minds of terrorists, and it was much quoted in the years after 9/11. I did so myself in my book America Alone, recalling one of the first and most famous literary images of terrorism, as Conrad sends his lone anarchist out of the house to pad the streets of central London with a bomb strapped to his chest. The power of the image lies in the bomber's isolation from the swarm of Londoners all around him. Tradesmen, servant girls, gentlemen of quality, charwomen, accountants, costermongers, all blissfully unaware of the man in their midst with his hand in his pocket and his finger on the detonator. A man alone in a tide of humanity, the Protean suicide bomber. I shall never be arrested. The game isn't good enough for any policeman of them all. To deal with a man like me, you require sheer, naked, inglorious heroism. Again his lips closed with a self-confident snap. Ossipon repressed a movement of impatience.
Or recklessness, or simply ignorance, he retorted. They've only to get somebody for the job who does not know you, carry enough stuff in your pocket to blow yourself and everything within 60 yards of you to pieces.
I never affirmed I could not be eliminated, rejoined the other, but that wouldn't be an arrest. Moreover, it's not so easy as it looks.
Pah! Ossipon contradicted. Don't be too sure of that. What's to prevent half a dozen of them jumping upon you from behind in the street? With your arms pinned to your sides, you could do nothing, could you?
Yes, I could. I'm seldom out in the streets after dark, said the little man impassively, and never very late. I walk always with my right hand closed round the india rubber ball which I have in my trouser pocket. The pressing of this ball actuates a detonator inside the flask I carry in my pocket. It's the principle of the pneumatic instantaneous shutter for a camera lens. The tube leads up with a swift disclosing gesture. He gave Ossipon a glimpse of an india rubber tube resembling a slender brown worm, issuing from the armhole of his waistcoat and plunging into the inner breast pocket of his jacket. His clothes, of a nondescript brown mixture, were threadbare and marked with stains, dusty in the folds with ragged buttonholes. The detonator is partly mechanical, partly chemical, he explained with casual condescension.
It is instantaneous, of course, murmured Ossipon with a slight shudder.
Far from it, confessed the other, with a reluctance which seemed to twist his mouth dolorously. A full 20 seconds must elapse from the moment I press the ball till the explosion takes place.
Phew! Whistled Ossipon, completely appalled. 20 seconds, horrors! You mean to say that you could face that? I should go crazy!
Wouldn't matter if you did. Of course, It's the weak point of this special system, which is only for my own use. The worst is that the manner of exploding is always the weak point with us. I'm trying to invent a detonator that would adjust itself to all conditions of action, and even to unexpected changes of conditions. A variable and yet perfectly precise mechanism. A really intelligent detonator.
20 seconds, muttered Ossipon again. Ugh! And then...
With a slight turn of the head, the glitter of the spectacles seemed to gauge the size of the beer saloon in the basement of the renowned Silenus restaurant.
Nobody in this room could hope to escape, was the verdict of that survey. Nor yet this couple going up the stairs now.
The piano at the foot of the staircase clanged through a mazurka with brazen impetuosity, as though a vulgar and impudent ghost were showing off. The keys sank and rose mysteriously. Then all became still. For a moment, Ossipon imagined the overlighted place changed into a dreadful black hole, belching horrible fumes, choked with ghastly rubbish of smashed brickwork and mutilated corpses. He had such a distinct perception of ruin and death that he shuddered again.
And the incorruptible professor walked too, averting his eyes from the odious multitude of mankind. He had no future. He disdained it. He was a force. His thoughts caressed the images of ruin and destruction. He walked frail, insignificant, shabby, miserable, and terrible in the simplicity of his idea, calling madness and despair to the regeneration of the world. Nobody looked at him. He passed on unsuspected and deadly, like a pest in the street full of men.
How does this happen? Why do civilized societies permit their enemies to destroy them from within? Well, civilization, by definition, is a softening process. That's been an underlying theme of several of our tales this past year, including even one ostensibly for children. Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, published in 1902, are really a collection of origin stories, how the camel got his hump, how the leopard got his spots. Many evolutionary biologists have pointed out that Kipling's venturing somewhat whimsically onto their terrain, seeking to answer the same questions they pursue, how the elephant got his trunk and so forth. Some of these tales take us, as you'd expect from Kipling, to the far corners of British rule, the deserts and felt and jungles whose incorporation within Her Majesty's dominions made kangaroos and elephants familiar figures in the imaginations of English youth. But other tales are more mythic and fabulous and primal. And I confess to a particular fondness for this story, The Cat That Walked by Himself. Charles Carrington, Kipling's first official biographer, said that, quote, "I sometimes think The Cat That Walked is R.K.'s masterpiece, the best story he ever wrote of any kind. Indeed, it's not merely fanciful like some of the other Just So stories, but oddly profound. It deals with what's now an extremely unfashionable subject, the role of the sexes, not genders, which is via French nouns and whatnot, but the sexes, all two of them, man and woman. We begin long ago, when man was, in Kipling's words, dreadfully wild until woman tames him."
Hear and attend and listen, for this befell and behappened and became and was, O my best beloved, when the tame animals were wild. The dog was wild, and the horse was wild, and the cow was wild, and the sheep was wild, and the pig was wild as wild could be. And they walked in the wet wild woods by their wild lones. But the wildest of all the wild animals was the cat. He walked by himself, and all places were alike to him. Of course, the man was wild too. He was dreadfully wild. He didn't even begin to be tame till he met the woman. And she told him that she did not like living in his wild ways. She picked out a nice dry cave instead of a heap of wet leaves to lie down in, and she strewed clean sand on the floor, and she lit a nice fire of wood at the back of the cave, and she hung a dried wild horse skin, tail down, across the opening of the cave, and she said, "Wipe your feet, dear, when you come in, and now we'll keep house." That night, best beloved, they ate wild sheep roasted on the hot stones and flavoured with wild garlic and wild pepper, and wild duck stuffed with wild rice and wild fenugreek and wild coriander, and marrow bones of wild oxen and wild cherries and wild grenadillas. Then the man went to sleep in front of the fire, ever so happy, but the woman sat up combing her hair. She took the bone of the shoulder of mutton, the big fat blade bone, and she looked at the wonderful marks on it, and she threw more wood on the fire, and she made a magic. She made the first singing magic in the world. Out in the wet wild woods, all the wild animals gathered together, where they could see the light of the fire a long way off, and they wondered what it meant. Then Wild Horse stamped with his wild foot and said, "Oh, my friends, and oh, my enemies! Why have the man and the woman made that great light in that great cave, and what harm will it do to us?" Wild Dog lifted up his wild nose and smelled the smell of roast mutton and said, "I will go up and see and look and say, for I think it is good. Cat, come with me."
"Ninny," said the cat. "I am the cat who walks by himself, and all places are alike to me. I will not come."
"Then we can never be friends again," said Wild Dog, and he trotted off to the cave.
He lifted up the dried horse skin with his nose and sniffed the beautiful smell of the roast mutton. And the woman, looking at the blade bone, heard him and laughed and said, "Here comes the first wild thing out of the wild woods. What do you want?"
Wild Dog said, "Oh, my enemy and wife of my enemy, what is this that smells so good in the wild woods?"
Then the woman picked up a roasted mutton bone and threw it to Wild Dog and said,
"Wild thing out of the wild woods, taste and try."
Wild Dog gnawed the bone, and it was more delicious than anything he had ever tasted. And he said,
"Oh, my enemy, and wife of my enemy, give me another."
The woman said,
"Wild thing out of the wild woods, help my man to hunt through the day and guard his cave at night, and I will give you as many roast bones as you need."
"Ah," said the cat, listening, "this is a very wise woman, but she is not so wise as I am."
Wild Dog crawled into the cave and laid his head on the woman's lap and said,
"Oh, my friend and wife of my friend, I will help your man to hunt through the day, and at night I will guard your cave."
"Yeah," said the cat, listening, "that is a very foolish dog."
And he went back through the wet wild woods, waving his wild tail and walking by his wild lone. Domestication, or over-domestication, is also a theme of H.G. Wells's great novel of 1895. Even if you've never read a word of Wells, you've heard of the time machine, if only because that bald designation which the author invented for his book, has been applied to more or less every time-travelling contraption concocted in the ensuing century. But for our purposes, Wells' story is less relevant for what it tells us about a distant future than for what it says about the here and now, about our time. In the original novella, a fellow in late Victorian England saddles up the eponymous time machine, propels himself forward, and finds himself in a world where humanity is bifurcated into two separate groups. The Eloi, a small, soft, passive, decadent, vegetarian elite, among whom one can scarce tell the boys from the girls, and the Morlocks, a dark, feral, subterranean underclass. This is supposedly London in the year 802,701 AD. That's the only thing Wells got wrong. He was off by a mere 800,685 years. If he'd set his time machine to nip ahead just 100 or so to the early 21st century, he'd have been bang on target. Today, an insular, myopic Eloi while away the hours conversing with the flowers, barely conscious of the snarling, predatory Morlocks mostly out of sight. Wells took the trend lines of the late 19th century, projected them out a ways, and got so much right. Not least a world where the Eloi have evolved beyond their capacity to produce. Everything is made out of sight. In Wells's world, underground. In ours, in the third world, in China, India, and beyond. Even the physiognomical distinctions are shrewd, prefiguring as they did a world in which the most advanced and comfortable persons are small and svelte vegetarians, while the poorer and cruder populations are the larger. This wasn't the case in late Victorian England. And one other thing I don't think I noticed until more recently, the Eloi's inability to communicate beyond simple childlike phrases, and their discombobulation when the time traveller attempts to move the conversation beyond their very, very shrivelled comfort zone. The Eloi are as easily triggered as the snowflakes of today. Ooh, that's transphobic. Ooh, that's racist. And like the snowflakes, the Eloi seek only to live in the banality and delusion of their safe spaces. A very prophetic work by H.G. Wells. He was a slight creature, perhaps 4 feet high, clad in a purple tunic, girdled at the waist with a leather belt. Sandals or buskins, I could not clearly distinguish which, were on his feet. His legs were bare to the knees, and his head was bare. He struck me as being a very beautiful and graceful creature, but indescribably frail. His flushed face reminded me of the more beautiful kind of consumptive, that hectic beauty of which we used to hear so much. In another moment, we were standing face to face, I and this fragile thing out of futurity. He came straight up to me and laughed into my eyes. The absence from his bearing of any sign of fear struck me at once. Then he turned to the two others who were following him and spoke to them in a strange and very sweet liquid tongue. There were others coming, and presently a little group of perhaps 8 or 10 of these exquisite creatures were about me. There was nothing in this at all alarming. Indeed, there was something in these pretty little people that inspired confidence, a graceful gentleness, a certain childlike ease,
And besides, they looked so frail that I could fancy myself flinging the whole dozen of them about like ninepins. And then, looking more nearly into their features, I saw some further peculiarities in their Dresden China type of prettiness. The eyes were large and mild, and, this may seem egotism on my part, I fancied even that there was a certain lack of the interest I might have expected in them. As they made no effort to communicate with me, but simply stood round me smiling and speaking in soft cooing notes to each other, I began the conversation. I pointed to the time machine and to myself. Then, hesitating for a moment how to express time, I pointed to the sun. At once, a quaintly pretty little figure in checkered purple and white followed my gesture, and then astonished me by imitating the sound of thunder. For a moment I was staggered, though the import of his gesture was plain enough. The question had come into my mind abruptly. Were these creatures fools? You may hardly understand how it took me. You see, I had always anticipated that the people of the year 802,000 odd would be incredibly in front of us in knowledge, art, everything. Then one of them suddenly asked me a question that showed him to be on the intellectual level of one of our five-year-old children. Asked me, in fact, if I had come from the sun in a thunderstorm. It let loose the judgment I had suspended upon their clothes, their frail light limbs and fragile features. A flow of disappointment rushed across my mind. For a moment I felt that I had built the time machine in vain. I nodded, pointed to the sun, and gave them such a vivid rendering of a thunderclap as startled them. They all withdrew a pace or so and bowed. Then came one laughing towards me, carrying a chain of beautiful flowers altogether new to me, and put it about my neck. The idea was received with melodious applause, and presently they were all running to and fro for flowers, and laughingly flinging them upon me until I was almost smothered with blossom. A queer thing I soon discovered about my little hosts, and that was their lack of interest. They would come to me with eager cries of astonishment, like children. But like children, they would soon stop examining me and wander away after some other toy. It is odd, too, how speedily I came to disregard these little people. Then, in a flash, I perceived that all had the same form of costume, the same soft, hairless visage, and the same girlish rotundity of limb. It may seem strange, perhaps, that I had not noticed this before, but everything was so strange. Now I saw the fact plainly enough. In costume, and in all the differences of texture and bearing that now mark off the sexes from each other, these people of the future were alike. And the children seemed to my eyes to be but the miniatures of their parents. I judged then that the children of that time were extremely precocious, physically at least, and I found afterwards abundant verification of my opinion. Seeing the ease and security in which these people were living, I felt that this close resemblance of the sexes was, after all, what one would expect, for the strength of a man and the softness of a woman, the institution of the family, and the differentiation of occupations are mere militant necessities of an age of physical force. Where population is balanced and abundant, much childbearing becomes an evil rather than a blessing to the state. Where violence comes but rarely and offspring are secure, there is less necessity, indeed there is no necessity, for an efficient family, and the specialization of the sexes with reference to their children's needs disappears. We see some beginnings of this even in our own time, and in this future age it was complete.
Bifurcated humanity is also the theme of a famous story written 9 years before the time machine, a tale in which man is both Eloy and Morlock, and attempting to separate those sides of himself does not work out well. Robert Louis Stevenson wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and yes, it's Jekyll, not Jekyll. We always go back to the source in Tales for Our Time, even with the most famous stories, and Jekyll is how he said it. I would love, by the way, to be able to recreate every aspect of this tale before the innumerable film and TV and stage adaptations, but there's one thing we can't do, and that's restore the shock of the final revelation. Today, everyone knows that Jekyll is Hyde and Hyde is Jekyll, but they didn't know that when the book was first published in January of 1886, and that in Newmont shocked readers and critics alike. This wasn't a villain with some hold over the hero. This wasn't a vampire who flies in through the window and bites you in the neck. No, in Stevenson's tale, there's no point locking the windows because the monster is within. He's in you. The monster is your subconscious, to use a word that Pierre Janet, the French psychologist, would coin and Sigmund Freud would popularize a few years after this book's publication. Stevenson had been interested in duality a long time. The idea of literal self-transformation, when Jekyll becomes Hyde, he grows smaller, younger, hairier. That kind of self-transformation was something bizarre and unfamiliar to the Victorians. In our time, we self-transform routinely. Men can become women, Caitlyn Jenner. White people can become black, Rachel Dolezal. The theme of Stevenson's story, that one can separate and emphasize and expand different aspects of one's essential identity, is now taken for granted. Birth certificates list two fathers and no mothers, and no sex or gender of the child. The most immutable essence of identity, sex, race, is now mutable and will be accepted as even more so in the years ahead. If anything, a Victorian author understands the conflicts, the complexity, the contradictions of duality more subtly than we do. Dr. Jekyll thinks that if he separates his dark side off into Mr. Hyde, then what remains in Dr. Jekyll will be better, purer, more essentially good. But it doesn't work like that. Liberating his dark side doesn't make his good side better. In that sense, the vernacular expression, a Jekyll and Hyde character, isn't quite true to Stevenson. Hyde is evil, but Jekyll remains the same mix of good and bad. In other words, human.
O'clock had scarce rung out over London ere the knocker sounded very gently on the door. I went myself at the summons and found a small man crouching against the pillars of the portico. "Are you come from Dr. Jekyll?" I asked. He told me yes by a constrained gesture, and when I had bidden him enter, he did not obey me without a searching backward glance into the darkness of the square. There was a policeman not far off, advancing with his bull's-eye open. And at the sight, I thought my visitor started and made greater haste. These particulars struck me, I confess, disagreeably. And as I followed him into the bright light of the consulting room, I kept my hand ready on my weapon. Here at last I had a chance of clearly seeing him. I had never set eyes on him before, so much was certain. He was small, as I have said. I was struck besides with the shocking expression of his face, with his remarkable combination of great muscular activity and great apparent debility of constitution. And last but not least, with the odd subjective disturbance caused by his neighbourhood. This bore some resemblance to incipient rigour, and was accompanied by a marked sinking of the pulse. This person, who had thus from the first moment of his entrance struck in me what I can only describe as a disgustful curiosity, was dressed in a fashion that would have made an ordinary person laughable. His clothes, that is to say, although they were of rich and sober fabric, were enormously too large for him in every measurement, the trousers hanging on his legs and rolled up to keep them from the ground, the waist of the coat below his haunches, and the collar sprawling wide upon his shoulders. Strange to relate, this ludicrous accoutrement was far from moving me to laughter. Rather, as there was something abnormal and misbegotten in the very essence of the creature that now faced me, something seizing, surprising, and revolting. This fresh disparity seemed but to fit in with and to reinforce it. My visitor was indeed on fire with sombre excitement.
"Have you got it?" he cried. "Have you got it?"
And so lively was his impatience that he even laid his hand upon my arm and sought to shake me. I put him back, conscious at his touch of a sudden icy pang along my blood.
"I beg your pardon, Dr. Lanyon," he replied civilly enough, "and my impatience has shown its heels to my politeness. I come here at the instance of your colleague, Dr. Henry Jekyll, on a piece of business of some moment, and I understood..."
He paused and put his hand to his throat, and I could see, in spite of his collected manner, that he was wrestling against the approaches of the hysteria.
"There it is, sir," said I, pointing to the drawer, where it lay on the floor behind a table and still covered with the sheet.
He sprang to it and then paused and laid his hand upon his heart. I could hear his teeth grate with the convulsive action of his jaws, and his face was so ghastly to see that I grew alarmed both for his life and reason.
"Compose yourself," said I.
He turned a dreadful smile to me, as if with the decision of despair, plucked away the sheet. At sight of the contents, he uttered one loud sob of such immense relief that I sat petrified, and the next moment, in a voice that was already fairly well under control,
"Have you a graduated glass?" he asked.
I rose from my place with something of an effort and gave him what he asked. He thanked me with a smiling nod, measured out a few minims of the red tincture, and added one of the powders. The mixture, which was at first of a reddish hue, began, in proportion as the crystals melted, to brighten in colour, to effervesce audibly, and to throw off small fumes of vapour. Suddenly, and at the same moment, the ebullition ceased and the compound changed to a dark purple, which faded again more slowly to a watery green. My visitor, who had watched these metamorphoses with a keen eye, smiled, set down the glass upon the table, and then turned and looked upon me with an air of scrutiny.
"And now," said he, "to settle what remains, will you be wise? Will you be guided? Will you suffer me to take this glass in my hand and go forth from your house without further parley? Or is the greed of curiosity too much command of you? Think before you answer, for it shall be done as you decide. As you decide, you shall be left as you were before, and neither richer nor wiser, unless the sense of service rendered to a man in mortal distress may be counted as a kind of riches of the soul. Or, if you shall so prefer to choose, a new province of knowledge and new avenues to fame and power shall be laid open to you here, in this room, upon the instant, and your sight shall be blasted by a prodigy to stagger the unbelief of Satan.
Sir, said I, affecting a coolness that I was far from truly possessing, you speak enigmas, but I've gone too far in the way of inexplicable services to pause before I see the end.
It is well, replied my visitor. Lanyon, you remember your vows. What follows is under the seal of our profession. And now, you who have denied the virtue of transcendental medicine, you who have derided your superiors, behold!
He put the glass to his lips and drank at one gulp. A cry followed. He reeled, staggered, clutched at the table and held on, staring with injected eyes, gasping with open mouth. And as I looked there came, I thought, a change. He seemed to swell. His face became suddenly black, and the features seemed to melt and alter, and the next moment I had sprung to my feet and leaped back against the wall, my arm raised to shield me from that prodigy, my mind submerged in terror. Oh, God, I screamed, and oh, God, again and again, for there before my eyes, pale and shaken and half fainting and groping before him with his hands like a man restored from death, there stood Henry Jekyll. What he told me in the next hour, I cannot bring my mind to set on paper. I saw what I saw, I heard what I heard, and my soul sickened at it. And yet now, when that sight has faded from my eyes, I ask myself if I believe it, and I cannot answer. My life is shaken to its roots, sleep has left me. The deadliest terror sits by me at all hours of the day and night. I feel that my days are numbered and that I must die. And yet I shall die incredulous. As for the moral turpitude that man unveiled to me, even with tears of penitence, I cannot, even in memory, dwell on it without a start of horror. I will say but one thing, Utterson, and that, if you can bring your mind to credit it, will be more than enough. The creature who crept into my house that night was, on Jekyll's own confession, known by the name of Hyde, and hunted for in every corner of the land.
Mr. Hyde was the inspiration for, among many other derivatives, Marvel Comics' Big Bruiser, the Incredible Hulk from the Avengers. I have to say, if you're looking for superheroes, you've come to the wrong place. I'm so bored by superheroes. Iron Man 5, Cardboard Man 12, Franchise Man 37. I'm sick of those movies. My old colleague from the New Criterion, James Bowman, wrote a decade ago that the current vogue for big-screen superheroes helps to, quote, isolate and quarantine heroism in fantasyland. Heroism is what people who've been bitten by radioactive spiders do, or fellows who've been catapulted to Earth from the planet Krypton. So until something like that happens to you, you're best to steer clear. And so a world of superheroes leads to a world without heroes.
I've come to miss the amateur adventurers of 19th and 20th century fiction, chaps who'd find themselves caught up in something and decide to give it a go, initially because it's a ripping wheeze, but also because in some too stiff upper lip to say way, they understood honesty and decency required it. And so here, by way of redress, is the tale of an Englishman abroad on a hiking holiday who is called upon to impersonate a king at his coronation. That was the conceit, high concept, we'd call it now. At the time, Anthony Hope's writing career wasn't going too great, but one day, strolling back from a convivial lunch, the idea popped into his head, and he was so excited he wrote it up and finished it in 6 weeks. The central proposition, the ordinary man obliged to personate a monarch, electrified readers, and has been recycled in innumerable variations ever since. So here we are, in a hunting lodge in Zender, and the game is afoot. I awoke with a start and a shiver. My face, hair and clothes dripped water. And opposite me stood old Sapt, a sneering smile on his face and an empty bucket in his hand. On the table by him sat Fritz von Tarlenheim, pale as a ghost and black as a crow under the eyes. I leapt to my feet in anger. "Your joke goes too far, sir," I cried. "Tut, man, we've no time for quarrelling. Nothing else would rouse you. It's 5 o'clock. "I'll thank you, Colonel Sapt," I began again, hot in spirit, though I was uncommonly cold in body. "Rassendyll," interrupted Fritz, getting down from the table and taking my arm. "Look here." The king lay full length on the floor. His face was red as his hair, and he breathed heavily. Sapt, the disrespectful old dog, kicked him sharply. He did not stir, nor was there any break in his breathing. I saw that his face and head were wet with water, as were mine. "We've spent half an hour on him," said Fritz.
"He drank 3 times what either of you did," growled Sapt.
I knelt down and felt his pulse. It was alarmingly languid and slow. We three looked at one another. "Was it drugged, that last bottle?" I asked in a whisper.
"I don't know," said Sapt.
"We must get a doctor."
"There's none within 10 miles, and 1,000 doctors wouldn't take him to Strelsau today. I know the look of it. He'll not move for 6 or 7 hours yet."
"But the coronation," I cried in horror.
Fritz shrugged his shoulders, as I began to see was his habit on most occasions.
"We must send word that he's ill," he said.
"I suppose so," said I. Old Sapt, who seemed as fresh as a daisy, had lit his pipe and was puffing hard at it.
"If he's not crowned today," said he, "I'll lay a crown he's never crowned."
"But heavens, why?"
"The whole nation's there to meet him, half the army, I and Black Michael at the head. Shall we send word that the king's drunk?"
"That he's ill," said I in correction.
"Ill?" echoed Sapt with a scornful laugh. "They know his illnesses too well. He's been ill before."
"Well, we must chance what they think," said Fritz helplessly. "I'll carry the news and make the best of it."
Sapt raised his hand.
"Tell me," said he, "do you think the king was drugged?"
"I do," said I.
"And who drugged him?"
"That damned hound Black Michael," said Fritz between his teeth.
"Aye," said Sapt, "that he might not come to be crowned. Rassendyll here doesn't know our pretty Michael. What think you, Fritz? Has Michael no king ready? Has half Strelsau no other candidate? As God's alive, man, the throne's lost if the king show himself not in Strelsau today. I know Black Michael."
"We could carry him there," said I.
"And a very pretty picture he makes," sneered Sapt.
Fritz von Tarlenheim buried his face in his hands. The king breathed loudly and heavily. Sapt stirred him again with his foot.
"The drunken dog," he said. "But he's an Elfberg, and the son of his father, and may I rot in hell before Black Michael sits in his place.
For a moment or two we were all silent. Then Sapt, knitting his bushy grey brows, took his pipe from his mouth and said to me,
"As a man grows old, he believes in fate. Fate sent you here. Fate sends you now to Strelsau."
I staggered back, murmuring, "Good God!" Fritz looked up with an eager, bewildered gaze. "Impossible," I muttered. "I should be known."
"It's a risk. Against a certainty," said Sapt. "If you shave, I'll wager you'll not be known. Are you afraid?"
"Sir!"
"Come, lad, there, there. But it's your life, you know, if you're known. And mine. And Fritz is here. But if you don't go, I swear to you, Black Michael will sit tonight on the throne and the king lie in prison or his grave."
"The king would never forgive it," I stammered.
"Are we women? Who cares for his forgiveness?"
The clock ticked 50 times and 60 and 70 times as I stood in thought. Then I suppose a look came over my face, for old Sapt caught me by the hand, crying,
"You'll go?"
"Yes, I'll go," said I. And I turned my eyes on the prostrate figure of the king on the floor.
"There's a chance," said Fritz, with his first sign of hopefulness.
"If I escape detection," said I.
"If we're detected," said Sapt, "I'll send Black Michael down below before I go myself, so help me heaven. Sit in that chair, man."
I obeyed him. He darted from the room, calling, "Yosef! Yosef!" In 3 minutes he was back, and Yosef with him. The latter carried a jug of hot water, soap, and razors. He was trembling as Sapt told him how the land lay, and bade him shave me. Suddenly Fritz smote on his thigh. "But the king!"
"The king will be in the wine cellar. I'm going to carry him there now."
"If they find him?"
"They won't! How should they? Yosef will put them off."
"But..." Sapt stamped his foot.
"We're not playing," he roared. "My God, don't I know the risk? If they do find him, he's no worse off than if he isn't crowned today in Strelsau."
So speaking, he flung the door open and, stooping, put forth a strength I did not dream he had and lifted the king in his hands. For me, I sat down in an armchair, and as I sat there, half dazed, Yosef clipped and scraped me till my moustache and imperial were things of the past, and my face was as bare as the king's. And when Fritz saw me thus, he drew a long breath and exclaimed, "By Jove, we shall do it." In The Prisoner of Zenda, it's taken as read that duty and honour impose certain obligations upon the protagonists, male and female. Honour binds a woman too, as Queen Flavia tells Rassendyll. Neither character talks about it much, because honour by definition has to be lightly worn. The louder he talked of his honour, the faster we counted our spoons, etc. But honour... integrity, reputation can hinge on the smallest things, like a single check, a rubber check. That's to say, a check that bounces, that does not clear. The Rubber Check was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald in 1932 and hasn't really shown up much in the years since. But I was about the age of Fitzgerald's leading man when I first read this story, and I've never forgotten it. But when I bought my pad in New Hampshire, I was struck first by how brutally banks bounce checks and how public was the attendant humiliation.
You'd go to the general store and pinned up at the register would be checks for modest amounts, $17.89, $12.42, or even $3.08, but all marked by the bank NSF, not sufficient funds. And in a town of 700 or 800 people, the names on those three checks were known to all. You don't see that so much now, mainly because almost all the dusty general stores have closed, the chain supermarkets are disinclined to take checks at all without an extensive criminal background check, and what with all the heroin, the rural economy is more cash-based than it used to be. But the point of Fitzgerald's story still holds. You make one small misstep, and your life changes. And in that sense, this tale is the very essence of storytelling. I've occasionally observed that all effective storytelling is conservative because it takes a conservative view of personal responsibility, that choices have consequences. And that's why I have a fondness for this piece. A young man in the whirl of the endless summer of youth makes a choice with nary a thought, sloughs off an inconsequential act, and as he discovers, it proves to be the swift, merciless hinge of his entire life, devastating in its catastrophic ordinariness. As a young fellow, swimming a little out of his depth socially, finds himself presented with the bill at a swank Philadelphia restaurant. The waiter laid a check at his elbow. Val started. He had had no intention of giving the party, but no one spoke up. The men at the table were as young as himself and as used to being paid for. He carried the check into his lap and looked at it. It was for $80, and he had $9.65. Once more he glanced about the table. Once more he saw Mercia Templeton's eyes fixed suspiciously upon him. "Bring me a blank check," he said. "Yes, sir." In a minute the waiter returned. "Could you come to the manager's office?" "Certainly." Waiting for the manager, he looked at the clock. It was 4:15. "I find I'm a little short," he said in his easy voice. "I came down for a dance and I miscalculated. Can you take my check on," he named his mother's bank, "for $100? He had once before done this in an emergency. He hadn't an account at the bank, but his mother made it good. He was an impressive figure. At Miss Nancy Lamb's debutante dance, he stood in the stag line like a very pillar of the social structure. He was only 22, but for 3 years he had attended such functions, and viewing this newest bevy of girls, he felt rather as if he himself were bringing them out. Cutting in on one of the newest and prettiest, he was struck by a curious expression that passed over her face. As they moved off together, her body seemed to follow him with such reluctance that he asked, "Is something the matter?" "Oh, Val," she hesitated in obvious embarrassment, "would you mind not dancing with me any more tonight?" He stopped in surprise. "Why? What's the matter?" She was on the verge of tears. "Mother told me she didn't want me to." As Val was about to demand an explanation, he was cut in on. Shocked, he retreated to the stag line and recapitulated his relations with the girl.
He had danced with her twice at every party. Once he had sat beside her at supper. He had never phoned her or asked if he could call. In 5 minutes, another girl made him the same request. "But what's the matter?" he demanded desperately. "Oh, I don't know, Val. It's something you're supposed to have done." Again he was cut in on before he could get definite information. His alarm grew. He could think of no basis upon which any girl's mother should resent his dancing with her daughter. He was invariably correct and dignified. He never drank too much. He had tried to make no enemies. He had been involved in no scandal. The next hour was horrible. Half a dozen girls with whom he usually danced asked him with varying shades of regret not to dance with them any more. One girl admitted that she had been so instructed, but intended to dance with him anyhow. And from her he learned the truth, that he was a young man who foisted bad checks upon trusting Philadelphians. No doubt his pocket was full of such paper, which he intended to dispose of to guileless debutantes. With helpless rage, he glared up at the calm dowagers in the balcony. Then, abruptly, and without knowing exactly what he was going to say, he mounted the stairs. At the moment, Mrs. Templeton was alone. She turned her lorgnette upon him, cautiously, as one uses a periscope. She did not recognize him, or she pretended not to. "My name is Val Schuyler," he blurted out, his poise failing him. "About that check in Philadelphia, I don't think you understand. It was an accident. It was a bill for a luncheon for your guests. College boys do those things all the time. It doesn't seem fair to hold it against me to tell New York people." For another moment, she stared at him. "I don't know what you're talking about," she said coldly, and swung herself and her lorgnette back to the dancers. "Oh, yes, you do." He stopped, his sense of form asserting itself. He turned and went downstairs and directly to the coat room. I have always loved stories that are set in motion by something small, careless, a single check, or in this next case, the choice of location to build a fire. For our final excerpt in this Tales for Our Time sampler, here's a brilliant short piece. Jack London wrote it in 1902 and then substantially revised it 6 years later, and the 1908 version is, I believe, one of the greatest short stories ever written. It's also one of the simplest. A man and a dog are hiking the Yukon Trail on a cold day to meet up with the boys at the Henderson Creek camp in time for supper. That's it. That's the whole thing. And yet it's a great and profound story. The implicit theme is one with great appeal to those of us who live in a part of the world where Mother Nature spends half the year trying to kill you. The fragility of security, of civilization, in the broadest sense that we're all walking on thin ice. And the more particular one, specific to North America, I think, that I'm reminded of if ever I walk behind some crappy bit of ugly strip mall in the North Country, and suddenly within a few yards you're in mountains and forests stretching for miles. That sense of a thin ribbon of civilization clinging to wilderness. Man can never tame nature, and one of the themes of this story is the difference between the human who exercises his judgment and the dog who has merely instincts. And the instincts prove to be surer than the judgment, as the cold of the Yukon seeps into every inch of the man's body and into every word of Jack London's tale.
And then it happened. At a place where there were no signs, the man broke through. It was not deep. He was wet to the knees before he got out of the water to the firm snow. He was angry and cursed his luck aloud. He had hoped to get into camp with the boys at 6 o'clock, and this would delay him an hour. Now he would have to build a fire and dry his moccasins and socks. This was most important at that low temperature. He knew that much. So he turned aside to the bank, which he climbed. On top, under several small pine trees, he found some firewood which had been carried there by the high water of last year. There were some sticks, but also larger branches, and some dry grasses. He threw several large branches on top of the snow. This served for a foundation and prevented the young flame from dying in the wet snow. He made a flame by touching a match to a small piece of tree bark that he took from his pocket. This burned even better than paper. Placing it on the foundation, he fed the young flame with pieces of dry grass and with the smallest dry sticks. He worked slowly and carefully, realizing his danger. Gradually, as the flame grew stronger, he increased the size of the sticks with which he fed it. He sat in the snow, pulling the sticks from the bushes under the trees and feeding them directly to the flame. He knew he must not fail. When it is 75 below zero, a man must not fail in his first attempt to build a fire. This is especially true if his feet are wet. If his feet are dry and he fails, he can run along the trail for half a mile to keep his blood moving. But the blood in wet and freezing feet cannot be kept moving by running when it is 75 degrees below. No matter how fast he runs, the wet feet will freeze even harder. All this the man knew. The old man on Sulphur Creek had told him about it, and now he was grateful for the advice. Already all feeling had gone from his feet. To build the fire, he had been forced to remove his mittens, and the fingers had quickly become numb. His pace of 4 miles an hour had kept his heart pushing the blood to all parts of his body, but the instant he stopped, the action of the heart slowed down. He now received the full force of the cold. The blood of his body drew back from it. The blood was alive, like the dog. Like the dog, it wanted to hide and seek cover away from the fearful cold. As long as he walked 4 miles an hour, the blood rose to the surface, but now it sank down into the lowest depths of his body. His feet and hands were the first to feel its absence. His wet feet froze fast. His bare fingers were numb, although they had not yet begun to freeze. Nose and face were already freezing, while the skin of all his body became cold as it lost its blood. But he was safe. Toes and nose and face would be only touched by the frost, because the fire was beginning to burn with strength. He was feeding it with sticks the size of his finger. In another minute, he would be able to feed it with larger branches. Then he could remove his wet moccasins and socks. While they dried, he could keep his naked feet warm by the fire, rubbing them first with snow. The fire was a success. He was safe. He remembered the advice of the old man on Sulphur Creek and smiled. The man had been very serious when he said that no man should travel alone in that country after 50 below zero. Well, here he was. He had had the accident. He was alone. And he had saved himself. Those old men were rather womanish, he thought. All a man must do was to keep his head. He was all right. Any man who was a man could travel alone. But it was surprising, the rapidity with which his face and nose were freezing, and he had not thought his fingers could lose their feeling in so short a time. Without feeling, they were, because he found it very difficult to make them move together to grasp a stick. They seemed far from his body and from him. When he touched a stick, he had to look to see whether or not he was holding it. All of which mattered little. There was the fire, promising life with every dancing flame. He started to untie his moccasins. They were coated with ice. The thick socks were like iron, almost to the knees. The moccasin strings were like ropes of steel. For a moment he pulled them with his unfeeling fingers. Then, realizing the foolishness of it, he grasped his knife. But before he could cut the strings, it happened. It was his own fault, or instead his mistake. He should not have built the fire under the pine tree. He should have built it in an open space. But it had been easier to pull the sticks from the bushes and drop them directly on the fire. Now, the tree under which he had done this carried a weight of snow on its branches. No wind had been blowing for weeks, and each branch was heavy with snow. Every time he pulled a stick, he shook the tree slightly. There'd been just enough movement to cause the awful thing to happen. High up in the tree, one branch dropped its load of snow. This fell on the branches beneath. This process continued, spreading through the whole tree. The snow fell without warning upon the man and the fire was dead. Where it had burned was a pile of fresh snow. The man was shocked. It was like hearing his own judgment of death. For a moment he sat and stared at the spot where the fire had been. A simple, brilliant story. A kind of dialogue between two characters, a man and a cruel climate, that teaches us something about the fragility of security and of civilization. You put a foot wrong, and it all falls away in an instant. We will have opportunities to relearn that lesson in the years ahead. And we will have brilliant, insightful perspectives on them in the stories we tell here at Tales for Our Time. We didn't get to all the tales we've done this last year, Gogol, Dickens, and even me. But we do have them all available in our archive, and we will have many more in the year ahead. And if you would like to join us each month, all you need to do is sign up for the Mark Stein Club. To return to the BBC and the dear departed Listen With Mother, are you sitting comfortably? Then let year two of Tales for Our Time begin.
Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time is a production of Oak Hill Media and Mark Stein Enterprises. All rights reserved.